Hello and welcome, everyone. This is the Boiled Leather Audio Hour, and we are at the issue 25, which makes up a little semi-anniversary here. I guess we have to do something special for episode 50, but right now we're only at 25, so let's push that into the future. This is Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand. I have my own blog at the nerdstreamera.blogspot.com, and with me, as always, is your beloved...
Sean T. Collins. I am the creator of All Leather Must Be Boiled and A Song of Ice and Fire Game of Thrones blog hosted at boiledleather.com. I cover Game of Thrones and a variety of other television programs for Rolling Stone and various other outlets. And I am the co-author of the official annotated Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia from Westeros.org and series editor Anne Grohl for the Subtext iPad app.
Your list is always longer than mine. It makes me envious. I have to add stuff here. So our topic today is the sample chapter that was included in the new paperback issue of A Dance with Dragons, because George R. R. Martin and obviously his publisher thought it was a good publicity move to include a Barristan Selmy POV chapter. It is rather short, so we estimate this will be a short podcast, but these predictions have turned out to be wrong in the past, so no holds barred. Bard, and we will go at this chapter and simply talk a bit about it. So, other than it being pretty short, what did you think about the chapter?
Well, I guess you know it's a chapter that's light on thematic or character meat, if you will. It's mostly setting up the battle of Meereen or for Meereen or the Battle of Fire, as it's sort of come to be. Colloquially known in anticipation of its eventual occurrence in The Winds of Winter. It exists mostly to lay out the situation on the ground in Meereen and outside Meereen's walls. It's Barristan being sort of Barristan exposition, telling us who he's got and who they've got and what he wants to do and how he hopes things will work and what he fears could go wrong. The one big exception, I suppose, in terms of giving you something a little bit more substantial to talk about than just rattling off the cool names and interesting-sounding tactical decisions that are being made, is Barristan's enormously depressing pep talk that he gives to his men as they're about to, and women, the pit fighters at least, are a fairly equal rights amendment adhering to. His soldiers on, you know, in anticipation of battle. And I alluded to this in our last podcast discussing The Princess and the Queen, where Barristan's speech in this preview chapter is about as explicit an encapsulation of Martin's point of view about war, insofar as Martin has made that explicit in interviews outside of the books. The quote, and I'm quoting from a somewhat perhaps disreputable transcription of the YouTube audio that's out there that I'm sure we'll link to in this post. Nothing is more dreadful upon this earth, nothing more glorious, nothing more absurd. That's Barristan on battle, and there you have it. Sort of that's Martin's point of view on war in general, at least as far as a fantasy writer goes. You know, if you're writing fantasy, you're going to want your battles to be engaging and entertaining. But if you're George R. R. Martin writing about fantasy, you're also going to want to make sure that the horror of it, the dreadful nature of it, the absurd nature of it comes through as well. And then there's Barristan gives this long litany of bodily functions that you may involuntarily undergo, which is in a weird way seems a little bit like Martin borrowing back from Benioff and Weiss in the conversation that King Robert had with Sir Barristan back in Game of Thrones season 1, where he talks about how no one ever tells you that everyone shits themselves in battle, which was one of Benioff and Weiss's first major inventions in that series, and a conversation that I think struck a lot of people as very strong. So there is almost the extent of the stuff that you can really tear into as a critic, as a thinker, if you will. And of course, since that's what I am, that's what I gravitate to, he says as he sticks his pinky out in the air and drinks his tea. Anyway. Stefan, what did you think?
just to give everyone more pictures to roll about in their heads. Right, I mean, these course. Guys are armored, and now they are shitting themselves. So I guess they can be uncomfortable mm-hmm. at times, mm-hmm. you know. I did live action role playing for a time, and I also had for a very long time a full armor plate at home. And what I really fast found out, if you have this thing on, you can take a piss, which can be really, really uncomfortable. it is totally impossible to do stuff like that. So, and these battles tend to be long. So there you have your pictures in your head.
Hooray.
I definitely agree that this chapter is as much setup as anything. I mean, we get a really detailed overview about the strategy that the Myrinese forces will engage in and where everybody is standing, all that stuff that is pretty unusual for Martin. Normally, he doesn't give us such a detailed overview, a bird's perspective, if you will, because normally he likes to emphasize the chaos of battle. I mean, think of the Whispering Wood with its telling through just the audio. Then we have Tyrion in the Battle of the Green Ford, where everything is just chaos and carnage. Then we have Tyrion in the Battle of King's Landing, which is also very chaotic. You get conflicting messages and all the stuff. But here it is nice and neat. You know, we stand here, we stand here, we stand here, and then we open the gate and do this, and I have the feeling that this will go awfully wrong. it just seems like this setup is there to be broken into pieces. So the dragons, of course, are the most stressful thing here that can happen, and I guess will happen. We have the foreshadowing in Barristan thinking about the silver he rides, that the horse is accustomed to dragons, which he hopes will give him an advantage. I don't know whether Rhaenyra would agree, but there you have it. So it is really this setup for the battle to come, and we already know that it will at least span two other chapters, another Barristan chapter, a Tyrion chapter, and I would guess also a Victarion chapter. So this will be second only to the King's Landing battle that was also told from different perspectives at the same time. And I guess it is really a very big battle that is coming up. And I don't know why I can't really get my head around it yet, because as I remember, it was initially to be in A Dance with Dragons as the big finale. And now it will be right in the beginning of The Winds of Winter. And I'm really curious how this will work out in the pacing of the narrative. You know, a big battle and then the dust will settle, I guess. So how will that feel?
Yeah, you have a climax at the beginning of the book, and apparently most likely two climaxes insofar as you'll have the Battle of Ice between Stannis' forces and the Bolton Frey alliance going on at the same time, or roughly the same time. So then, I don't know, is there going to be a long lull and then you ratchet things up with the others, or is it just a continuous full-out heavy metal immigrant song assault of nonstop action? I'm sure a lot of people wouldn't mind that. And I actually think from a marketing perspective, it's smart to include this as the preview chapter that goes into the mass market paperback edition of A Dance with Dragons, as opposed to any of the other preview chapters that we've encountered, because this is the one that points you most directly towards the coming battle.
Yeah,
and I think
right.
that a lot of readers are going to want that or need that even when they reach the end of Dance and are like, huh? That's it? Because as you say, the book was conceived with those battles taking place at the end. But they don't, for various reasons, and of spacing, and I'd imagine of pacing as well. And
I think it's a smart decision, but it is definitely unusual.
Yeah, it is definitely unusual. It's not going to matter when all the books are finished, as everybody said at the time when the book came out. It's not going to matter when all the books are out and you can read them all in a row. It won't really matter what happened, you know which collection of pieces of paper you're holding in your hand when this happens, because it's going to happen at roughly the same time. But yeah, I think it's smart from that perspective. And you're right, you know, I don't see the plans. I don't see things going according to plan. I couldn't find it, but there's a relatively famous saying by an extremely famous boxer that like plans evaporate when you take your first punch, and that's true. And what I think is smart about having this is that we, in the audience will now be able to tell what's going right and what's going wrong. It's essentially an establishing shot that lets you get the lay of the land and lets you see what's supposed to happen, what your resources are, what's out there, what's available. And we'll have a better sense of what individual incidents mean now that we've been given this context, which I appreciate. As a comics person, much to the chagrin of some of my readers, as a comics person, I think a lot about action and how it's depicted in comics. And you'd be surprised, given that it's a visual medium, how lazy those depictions tend to be in terms of establishing an environment, establishing stakes and consequences for each individual stage of a battle or a fight. A lot of times it's just drawings of people shooting lasers and punching in all different directions, and you'll get a few cutaway panels that show individual people making contact, but you don't really understand why anything happens. At the end of a bunch of pages of chaos, one side
like
will have won.
Like a Michael Bay movie.
Yeah, exactly, like a Michael Bay movie. One side will have won and one side will have lost. And having Barristan spell out the geography, the forces, the fighting styles in some cases, the tactics, what he foresees happening, what he foresees going wrong, as the battle proceeds, and assuming, as I think is safe to assume, there'll be all sorts of wild cards on the way, like Victarion, and most likely Daenerys. At least as far as I'm concerned, you now have a baseline from which you can judge what's going on, and I think that's very helpful.
Okay, let's do the nerd thing and engage in a little bit of strategy.
Okay.
The thing that initially struck me was that they leave all the brazen beasts behind. And I'm not quite sure why Barristan does it. Of course, you have something to fall back on. I understand that. But I have the feeling that he simply doesn't trust the Shavepate and that he doesn't want the guys on the battlefield, which seems a very Barristan thing to do, you know. It is a major force, but I don't really trust the guy, so I don't take them in. I'm not quite sure whether it is a clever decision. What do you think?
Well, you know, he could be leaving them behind just because he needs someone to keep the city pacified. And he's leaving that to the Brazen Beasts. But given the sort of rise in the fandom following... Well, I mean, let's be honest, you know, thanks to the Myrinese blot, arguing fairly persuasively, I think, that the Shavepate was behind the attempted assassination of Daenerys and that he got Barristan to be his unwitting cat's paw in unseating Hisdar. You know, that makes it a little bit more complicated, doesn't it? That,
yeah, definitely.
That the Shavepate and the Brazen Beasts have effectively been left with a monopoly of force within the walls of Meereen. Not a monopoly of force, because we know that the Sons of the Harpy are still out there and still able to act if they feel like it. So for all we know, there's going to be some brutal house-to-house fighting between the Brazen Beasts and the Sons of the Harpy while Barristan and his forces are out there trying to save the city from the, you know, the Slaver's Bay Alliance. So,
except if the Sons of the Harpy are the Shavepate's guys.
Oh man, that's quite a master conspiracy. That he's both sides.
Yeah,
at once.
I don't know. I mean, it is really strange.
Yeah, yeah.
But since Barristan doesn't suspect any of this, at any rate, I guess his reasoning will be. I mean, you pointed out you want a police force, especially when you know that a guerrilla force is in the city. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
Just not
quite sure. Right, well, because, you know, suspecting what we suspect, there's a lot to be mulled over about the intelligence of that particular decision. But I think one of the things that emerges that's interesting about Barristan is that he's a person who's aware of his limitations, but is continuously forced to go beyond them.
Yeah, you know, he has that in common with Ned Stark, obviously.
Yes, yes, yes. Ooh. Oh, yeah, very much so. Very much so. That's an interesting character type.
They are both constantly reminding us that they don't like intrigue and that they are not good at it. They're really suckers for the political game, and yet they are drawn in by guys quite more adept than they are. So there's quite a parallel, but I don't think that Barristan will get beheaded. And to get back to the question of just how this fight is beginning to unfold, I think it is... it is safe to say that the whole strategy of this thing, I mean, we got the strategy meeting back in A Dance with Dragons in the last Barristan chapter, where all the commanders are sitting around the table and are discussing. We don't get the results of the discussion. We just know that they talk for a very long time, the whole morning and the most of the afternoon. And then they, to quote Barristan, they acted as one, you know, so everyone is behind the plan. And I guess a very big part of this unison decision is that Barristan will lead the charge himself, which is, as I said, very Barristan to do, but also pretty stupid. So they are posing the question in this chapter. What happens if you fall? Here's the guy riding in front of everyone with on Daenerys' silver, with the two largest banners that they could find anywhere. So he's a number one target. And the question, what will happen if he dies? It is very justified. So what will happen if he dies?
I don't think he'll die. It just doesn't feel like the right time to me.
I also don't think that he will die. It is more a thought exercise.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I'll say is this. It's interesting that he sees himself as a symbol as much as he sees himself as a warrior or a commander. Batman. What'd you say?
He's Batman.
He is Batman, yes. He's not the Dark Knight, though. He's a very white knight. But that sort of tells you a lot about how Barristan sees his role. Now, the flip side of that is that if you break the bat signal, what value does that symbol have anymore? Would it be worse that he had never been out there if he's making himself such a target and then gets cut down? And as sort of the human person that's tying all the forces together, you know, I mean, we've already sort of seen them go through this with Daenerys' disappearance.
Yeah.
So when someone becomes larger than life, the bigger they come, the harder they fall, and the more of an impact they have on those left behind. So, it's an interesting decision he makes. Like I said, I don't think it'll come to that. It just doesn't feel like the right point in the story to me.
Yeah, definitely. I think it is pretty interesting his importance for holding these forces together. The Shaefpate was adamant from the beginning that he needs to be in. I mean, the Shaefpate goes over pains in his conspiracy to remove Hisdar with all this. We don't kill him. We do a trial. We do this. We can't do that. And he agrees to everything because it is clear from the get-go that the Unsullied will only fight if Barristan says so. Mm-hmm. Says so. Which points to a very broad base of respect that he has. The same is also true for the Freedmen. They are also taking the lead from Barristan. And I have to admit, I never saw him as such an authority figure before. I guess this is because he gets a POV character only at the end of Dance and has done his authority figure stuff in the background until then. Nobody got him on the radar, at least not Daenerys, who was our only POV until then. Yeah, so that's pretty interesting. The guy is obviously apt at getting a followership.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess you figure Barristan's kind of he's an impressive figure. You know, surely the reputation of the Kingsguard, you know, however diminished it's been since Robert took over, I don't know how much that diminution actually tarnishes Barristan, since Barristan served under previous kings. And, you know, by all accounts, he's really quite a formidable warrior. I do wonder, you know, there's some value in that. I'm sure if you're a sellsword captain or just some sellsword, you're like, well, this dude knows how to get it done. Okay, I'll listen to him. If you're a pit fighter, he just beat one of your best, right? So now all of a sudden the pit fighters are like, okay, all right, let's see what you can do, old man. You know, I think it's a combination of reputation and, you know, demonstrated capabilities that earn Barristan people's respect and willingness to follow him. It's not necessarily as messianic as the fervor that greets Daenerys for obvious reasons. But he's also Daenerys's right-hand man. So a lot of the respect and admiration and love that flowed into Daenerys, he's now sort of the default vessel for that.
You can't really imagine Ser Jorah wielding that kind of influence, even if he hadn't been disposed. Right. You know, he was a Lord Commander of the Queen's Guard before. Mm-hmm. So, but he would never have been able to do this, I guess. I mean, the Unsullied would have probably followed him because they are accustomed to following people, and he would have been the Queen's Guard. But the Freedmen and the Pit Fighters, I don't really see that. But this leads to a question I have mentioned earlier before we started recording. Kingsguard leading in battle is a pretty default move for many Targaryen kings. We have several instances in Westerosi history where Kingsguard were leading troops. I mean, obviously, we have Kristen Cole, the Kingsmaker, in the Dance of the Dragons, but we also have others fighting before and leading in battle in that capacity. I think in the Battle of the Redgrass Field, there are also Kingsguard fighting in pretty prominent positions, not guarding anyone, but used as battle commanders. And I guess the reason why Robert didn't do that is that his Kingsguard sucked, basically, and that he couldn't trust Jaime to lead a battle. Plus, he enjoyed it himself too much. But Barristan obviously knows his shit, you know? He is not just a knight good at clubbing other knights. He also knows about strategy. He is a bit hindered by his imaginations of duty and honor and all that stuff, but he's pretty efficient. I think you can say that.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, how many experienced battle commanders are at Marine's disposal right now? It doesn't seem like a whole lot unless you want to put everything in the hands of a sellsword, right? Which you don't.
Yeah, and you don't want to do that. Yeah. I mean, they don't have any experience with this kind of stuff.
Right, and you know, Grey Worm is not used. Grey Worm accepts commands; he doesn't issue commands, and so on and so forth. You know, the Pit Fighters are formidable, but they're not. That's a different kind of fighting that they're used to, and so on and so on.
Yeah, definitely.
So
I mean, the Meereenese commanders all died in the siege of Meereen when Dany took the city. I guess so.
But there is some. There is certainly something kind of exciting about seeing this return to the days of like Ser Criston Cole, where, you know, he'll take a whole army and do what he can do with it. You know,
yeah.
That is very cool from a nerdy perspective. Speaking of nerdy perspectives, one of the things that excited me the most was discovering in the enumeration of the individual warriors and captains who will be going into battle with Ser Barristan, is that among the Pit Fighters are a giant, apparently, an actual honest-to-God giant, and a brindled man. Now, even Gogor the Giant was there, towering above the others like a man amongst boys. Now, I suppose that you could say that maybe he's just a giant in the way that the mountain's a giant.
That's what I suspected, to be honest.
Yeah, and, you know, but I mean, I assume it's phrased this way in order to be ambiguous, because it's just kind of cool to think that they have a giant pit fighter. Which I agree, that's pretty cool. And then the brindled butcher, the brindled men are sort of a mysterious, I don't know what they are, group of people from Sothorios, you know, and I did a quick search and the Westeros.org message board popped up, and the Basilisk Isles teeming with escaped slaves, slavers, skinners, whores, hunters, brindled men, and worse. And then later there was a thing about brindle-skinned half-men from the jungles of Sothorios. So what do we think is the deal with these guys? Because if you look up brindle, which I had to do on Wikipedia, you're basically talking about animals that have brown fur with other colors sort of modeled in there. And does that mean that this group of men has fur? Does that mean that this group of men has basically brown skinned with other colors modeled in there? Are they humans like you and me and Barristan and Drogo and Jalabar Joe or whoever? Are they some sort of separate humanoid race like ostensibly the giants are?
I guess they are not a new race. It just isn't that kind of story. There are three possibilities left. They could be Neanderthals, like the really aged, the first men that we have. That's a possibility that they survive, but it also seems too fantasy for me, which leaves the other two possibilities. First, they have just a very strange skin color to underscore their otherness, or the other thing is that they use strange tattoos and stuff to look different. To me, it seems more like a cultural thing. I don't know why. It's just a gut feeling that this is referring to an appearance that has been created, not a natural one.
Well, the thing that draws me short about that is that generally when characters are extravagantly tattooed, whoever's describing them uses the word tattoo to describe them. And yeah, at no true. Point are the brindle, they're not talked about the way the slaves of Volantis are talked about. They're barely talked about at all. Which, again, I'm a big fan of anomalies. I'm a big fan of loose ends. I'm a big fan of dogs that don't bark, to use one of my personal favorite expressions.
And it is also a very good one.
Yes, thank you very much. And so I don't mind if we never get to the bottom of what the hell the brindled men are. Tolkien, for example, was just lousy with this kind of stuff. There was tons of things in the Lord of the Rings and related works where it's just like, what? Where things will be mentioned once or a couple of times, and you never quite get a handle on how it all fits together. Which is cool. I like that. I like having the world be a bit messy. It's perfectly conceivable that in this fantasy world, a separate evolutionary branch of humankind survived in Sothorios long enough to continue to interact with this basically medieval culture elsewhere in the world. Certainly Neanderthal man and Cro-Magnon coexisted for quite some time. So, it's not out of the realm of possibility, nor is it out of the realm of possibility that this is just a sort of vaguely fantastical skin color that exists in the world of Westeros and Essos, but not in our own, the same way that you can have in Westeros and Essos, like, entire nations full of people who have hair so blonde it's basically white, and, like, purple eyes and stuff, which doesn't really... I'm sorry, go ahead.
It reminds me very much of our discussion about the Lands of Ice and Fire. If you remember, there was this card of the East where all that stuff was mentioned we never heard before. These five cities and Yeti and the ghost grass field around Ashai. And all that weird stuff. And it seems to fall in this category with me. It's just thrown in because Essos is generally the other continent. It feels strange to us. It feels strange to Sir Barristan, and he seems to know what it is, or else it wouldn't be mentioned like, oh yeah, they are there too. It is just this, he seems to know what they are, and he isn't too upset about them. So that's the one thing, I guess, if it really was a different race of humans in the sense that it is another evolutionary branch, people would be more... would be mentioning it more,
Right. Well, I mean, so you would think, and so I would certainly think, but then I think back to how we hear about these other magical creatures that are out there, basilisks and manticores, and we even see some of them. And in Bran's vision, there are dragons flying around in Ashai, right? I don't know what we're supposed to take from any of that. Like, maybe some of these things that would be so fantastical to most of the characters we're surrounded with these things are taking place so far away or exist so far away that it just never quite registers. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what to make of it.
Yeah,
but I not knowing what to make of it. I'm perfectly satisfied with that. So.
Yeah, I have to be honest here because I didn't make any of it before you mentioned it. Now you got me thinking, but I have to come to the same conclusion. I really don't know if there is anything to it. Just the pacing of the story and keeping in mind that we only have two volumes left doesn't leave too much room for additional world building. So I guess we won't hear much about Brindled Men and all that kind of stuff. The right. Myrinese storyline is rapidly drawing to a close. So I don't think that we will linger in Essos and in the Essosi cultures for much longer.
Yeah, I think Volantis will play a big role, but then I think you're right in general. It's going to have to start solidifying and consolidating on Westeros in fairly short order for the series to make a whole lot of sense, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Volantis is fairly to the west, and I also guess, I mean, Daenerys has to free the Volantine slaves.
Right.
There was too much set up over Dance with Dragons to not revisit Volantis, which also kind of rules out all the theories about Daenerys coming from the Sunset Sea and all that stuff. I think we had this: to go west, you have to go east with Meereen. But, yeah, we will see.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's about all I have on this little chapter. Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up?
No, not really. I think we will have to wait for more of it. There is at least a transcript of the Tyrion chapter, I guess, and of the Barristan chapter or something. At least the other Barristan chapter has a transcript on the Westeros.org board. So if you are curious, you can check it out there. So that's all I have about the topic. And I guess we will have some more stuff to discuss the next time, but I won't disclose yet what we will talk about the next time.
A little mystery never hurt anybody. That's the whole point. Yeah, just embrace the mystery.
And set up. Yeah, I mean, I build up so much tension now. You will sit there every day. When will there be the next Boiled Leather Audio Hour? I can't wait.
All right, everybody. Well, thanks once again for listening. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Stefan. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, as always,
for all you wonderful people. And we will see you next time.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye.